Hello, my name is Terry, and I'm an alcoholic. And somebody could take my seat, as far as I'm concerned, right here. I want to have a seat. I'm an alcoholic, and I'm sober today, and I'm deeply grateful to be sober, and I'm grateful to be here, and I'm impressed, extra impressed with everybody who's standing up. It's hard to stand. At least for me it is. This is a lot of people here. Still moving around. Kind of coming in gradually. The important people are coming in. I'm somebody who lived with alcoholism. I guess most of us did, but I was living with alcoholism in a very kind of explicit way all my life. I grew up in a family with lots of alcoholics, and nothing too unusual about that around here. But what was a little unusual is that I was living, grew up in Hawthorne, California, near the airport down there. And my grandfather brought the Post article that came out in 1941, the one that's a pamphlet, Jack Alexander. He brought it over the month it came out. He drove over the special trip to our house and gave it to his son, my father, and said, "Son, find these people." That's kind of alcoholic my father was, and he was did find the people and went to meetings and brought home Easy Does It one day at a time. It's a disease. The first drink gets you drunk. Once an alcoholic, always an alcoholic. And I had all of that straight by the time I was 6 years old in Hawthorne. We talked about alcoholism a lot. My father had a few slips, and he died in withdrawal when I was a kid. And I knew what he died of. We all did. We all prayed for Daddy. We all were instructed, don't think badly of your father and your uncles. They got a disease. Say a prayer for them. And I had this extra kind of education about alcoholism, the way a lot of your kids are getting, you know. I was kind of a generation ahead of my time, you know, with talking about the disease and the mystery of the first drink. And I took a pledge not to drink till I was 21. That's what Catholic kids did in the 50s at confirmation time. An Irish bishop would show up, and it was kind of a Catholic version of just say no in those days. And it took a very courageous kid not to take the pledge. And I took the pledge not to drink till I was 21. Everybody said, "Don't worry about it. Nobody keeps the pledge. Have a drink." And I said, "I'm going to keep it." And I kept it. And went to the seminary, studied to be a priest. Stayed there 12 years. While I was there, I wrote a paper on alcoholism. 2 years before I had a drink, I read the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous and a bunch of other books on the disease and became kind of the village expert on alcoholism. And the rest of what I share tonight will let you know that if you get a pretty good education and have a good attitude, that it won't do you any good. That's kind of a cheap shot. I shouldn't have said that. I think it does do good to have it. I'm not cynical about education. But it doesn't help you not to be an alcoholic if you're wired to be one, if your chemistry's set up. Education, though, I think helps a lot. And it probably, the best effect it has is that it's probably a little harder to build a denial system that'll take you all the way to cirrhosis before you notice something's wrong. There's cracks in it earlier, you know. That's what I figure. Who knows? I don't know. I know that that when I turned 21, it was officially all right for me to drink, and I didn't forget that, you know. I noticed it. And my birthday was in the summer. I was out of school. There was no drinking in the seminary at all. And I went to store and bought a bottle of bourbon and sweet vermouth and Angostura bitters and maraschino cherries and worked out the recipe for a batch of Manhattans, followed it scrupulously. I was very careful. Mixed up some Manhattans, and there was a little birthday party, and you know, we talk about crossing the invisible line. A lot of, because many alcoholics start drinking, you kind of like it, you know, and have a lot of fun, and then some time goes by, and then there's just trouble. And then once there's trouble, there's always trouble. You know, there's no kind of, well, I had trouble there for a couple of years, then I had 5 years of those. No, it's just, it's hard. And once the, and they call it the invisible line, and sometimes people have a very hard time noticing when that happens. I crossed the invisible line sometime in the early afternoon of my 21st birthday. It was instant obsession. I just had a couple of drinks, and I just couldn't get over it. I thought, do you mean to tell me there are liquor stores open all over the country every day? Why does anybody go to work? And yet I knew that, yeah, it makes sense to go to work, and I should go, and you know, don't make the big deal out of this now. And if there's one thing that I can characterize my own drinking, is that drinking is a big deal to me. It was a big deal from the first day until now. It's a big deal right now. The biggest deal in my life is that I get to be sober. The absolute condition of having a life. Nothing's a bigger deal than that. There's nothing to trade away for that. It's a big deal. And when I got... And drinking, the high speaks to me. The way I understand my disease, it's just my system is a little different than them that aren't alcoholics. And it just says something special to me, because everything's going to be all right, because they can't get you now. You know, once I have a drink or two, the feeling goes down, and the feeling speaks to me. Yeah. Says, anything you say will be interesting. they can't get you. Don't worry, they can't get you. Nobody can get you now. I like to say drinking never made me happy, but it always made me feel like I was going to be happy in about 15 minutes. It was just this great promiser. I was obsessed. This was the, when can I drink next? And how much is there? And where is it? And how much, and who's looking? And how much, what can I get away with? I mean, I was right there. And I was in a social situation that encouraged moderation a lot. And so I was what, that most pitiful of all creatures, a booze spider. You know, a booze spider is a pathetic creature. A booze spider is somebody trying to do two things at once that are very different. I was trying to get as much to drink as I possibly could. And I was trying to make sure I didn't get drunk. And if you keep both things in mind all evening, it keeps you very busy. There's a lot of math involved in that. You got to keep figuring out how many minutes there are between drinks, and how big the drink is, and how fat the glass is, and how many ice cubes, and the percentage of alcohol in the basic source, whether it's 80 proof or 86 proof, or praise the Lord, bonded. And then you got to remember how far your car is away, and how far it is home, and what time it is, and what time you get up the next morning, and how much money you got, and who is this you're talking to. You got to keep track of a lot of things if you're going to be a good booze fighter. And I was constantly, you know, self-conscious and aware of all this stuff, and seemed like I tried a lot. I paid attention and tried to do it right. And every once in a while, I would have this release. Now, I like to say that I basically had two modes of drinking. Both were alcoholic, because I'm alcoholic. That's all I can do is drink alcoholically. But I had two different modes. One was the one I'm just describing, the mode of where I'd try to keep track of things, you know? And while you're trying to keep track of things, you kind of, my morale was still there, you know? You feel like you got a chance, you know? That there's always a little hope. You can, if you just try a little harder, say another prayer, you know, you might be all right. Just bear down, you know? And that mode, it's not very much fun, but it's the kind of the responsibility mode, you know? Now, every once in a while, I'd go into the other mode. And the other mode is the kind of thing where I would just lose interest in keeping track of things. I never knew when it was going to happen. It didn't seem to relate to the amount I drank. Sometimes I'd try to keep track of things all the way to the end. You know, just, I was in there trying to do it right. Right while I went down, you know. I'd pass out while I was trying to be good, you know. Other times, I'd just start off, and I'd know, tonight's different. You know? Usually I care when I'm supposed to get up the next day. I wonder why I don't care tonight. Usually I care. Usually I care who I'm talking to. Why don't I care who this is? Usually I care, and something happens where, and I, you know, I'd have a double reaction to that, you know. On the one hand, I'd feel, great, that's the whole idea, is to fly. The whole idea is to get, you know, unshackled, take off, you know, break through the clouds, and then freedom, get out of here, you know, fly. That's what I want to do. That was one reaction. The other reaction was different. You know, we talk about alcoholics having a sense of impending doom. You know why alcoholics have a sense of impending doom? Because doom is impending. once I'd go into that mode of not caring, not trying to keep track of things, the significance of that would register upon me. It would, down in my bones, it wouldn't so much be in my head. It would just be somewhere that my body knew, you know. It knew, and what you know, it, the message is,
you're a dead man.
Message is, it's all over. You know, you lose interest what side of the double line you're on, you're going to cross the double line, you know. If you're not looking out for holes in the street, you're going to step in a hole. You lose interest when you're supposed to get up the next day. Some days you will, some days you won't. It's kind of all over. And something in me knew that it doesn't matter how hard you try, if you just lose interest in trying occasionally, you're dead. And I think that message kind of comes through to us alcoholics and dope fiends kind of early. You know, there's a shadow. Even when there's not a lot of trouble, the something, you know, the shadow's over it. It says, you know, it's going to get worse. Because something in you doesn't give a damn, you know. You look like you're trying to other people. And you kind of want to keep trying, but you're not trying all the time. You try, and then you don't try. And so it's basically all over. Somehow I think that message comes through. I'm getting a little philosophical here. In my student days, I'm very obsessed and started having a few blackouts and doing things like, you know, I was invited to judge a beer drinking contest at a pizza parlor in Monterey Park. And I won. It's always a sign, you know. If you're the judge and you win, it's a sign. Things like that. And I was ordained a priest, and that I went down the tubes very quickly. I'm grateful to report. I'm grateful to report that. That's, you know, there's my brothers and sisters who kind of have the kind of stamina where they drink a fifth a day for 20 years before they notice something's wrong. My heart goes out because there's a lot of pain in that. You know, just like beyond the beyond pain. And I had the good fortune to be kind of a menace to the neighborhood early. And I was a booze fighter, but I had those moments where I'd lose interest trying, and so I'd keep flying off and not showing up. In my business, my line of work, that they put a premium on showing up. Lots of people get together in rooms like this, you know. And I was getting in trouble with my boss, and but long before that, I was thinking to myself, I did all this reading, you know, and I wrote this long paper, and I had all this information about alcoholism, and I gave it some thought. And even before I started drinking, I computed that I had about 50-50 chance of being an alcoholic. Because it ran, you know, runs in families, running in my family, you know, both sides. And I had an older brother. He was 6 years older than I am, and he showed a lot of signs of being normal. And I thought, statistically, that was not good for me. He's still showing signs of being normal. It's really disheartening, you see this guy. The kind with a good bottle of scotch, you know. Every year he has a drink out of it. Very responsible. I was kind of ready to kind of see things, but what I want to share, my story, is that, you know, big smarty, graduate degree, education and everything, with all this reading, I missed it, you know. I thought, one thing I knew about being an alcoholic is that if you are one, you're never going to learn to drink right, you know. If you are one, it's over, you don't get to drink at all. First drink gets you drunk. I had that, the physical part, kind of down. It's an allergy of the body coupled with an obsession of the mind. And that obsession of the mind kind of escaped me. I was under the impression that if you had somewhat of a decent sense of good sportsmanship, just that you don't have to have a wonderfully spiritual attitude, just a little bit of sense and some information and say a few prayers, and then when you notice you had symptoms of alcoholism, well, you just stop. You know, I thought once I noticed, if I was the type that got symptoms, and I saw that, well, I'm an educated man, I read about this stuff, you know, and once I saw the symptoms, I just knew I'd quit. And it wasn't so much that I thought, oh, you just quit because it's unspiritual to do that, or that you might die of cirrhosis, or not all of it. That wasn't it. The thing that made me convinced that I'd quit is that I couldn't imagine being like my Uncle Bill. And my Uncle Bill, who is a heroic alcoholic, but the thing about my Uncle Bill that I just couldn't imagine being was somebody who would get little kids and trap them and bore them to death. You know, do you ever have an uncle or breathe on you and have you trapped at night and quote poetry and tell old stories until you just want to die? And they won't let you alone. You can't go to sleep. I said, I'll never do that to a kid, you know. I'd never do that to anybody. I did that to people. When I started to act like that, it didn't register, you know. It didn't have the effect. And I just couldn't, as I was getting in more trouble, I thought, well, it looks like you got symptoms. I think you're getting symptoms. Blackouts, obsession, sneaking, you're sneaking a lot of drinking, you know. And so I was ready to say I was alcoholic. But I really thought, well, any minute now I'll stop. And I did stop one time. I always like to share this because it's so sick. I thought it was about 2 years after I was ordained, and I thought, you know, it's time to quit. And I actually quit. It was about almost 6 months. I was in the wagon. It went like this. I was first in a period of surprise and shock. I couldn't get over. I was really surprised. I quit. Because I was quitting all the time, but I'd start so quick afterwards I didn't want to count it as quitting. And after I got over the shock of quitting, I decided then I must be getting spiritual. I thought, pretty good, man. This isn't just good intentions. This is the real thing. This is performance. I think you might be growing up. Maybe you might be getting mature, by golly. And so I felt like I was getting a little more mature and spiritual. And that went on for 3 or 4 months. Into the 4th month, I had another attitude change. And I began to get worried that I just might stick to this. I thought, you know, might not be good for me. You know, some people, maybe they should have something. You know, I just might flip out someday and they'll find me babbling in a corner and no one will know what happened, you know. He waited too long to have a drink. And then I was about 5 months, and I thought, well, anybody that quit for 5 months would prove he can quit. I mean, that's a pretty good quit, 5 months. And as long as you're sure you got the talent to quit, and you might go crazy if you don't, you might as well have a drink. Because if there's any trouble in the future, you just quit fast and nip it in the bud. And if all of that made sense to you, what I just said, you're in the right place tonight. You're very sick. Non-alcoholics have a hard time following that sequence of reasoning. Huh? Huh? Alcoholics don't have any trouble there. By the way, if you're sitting here, or standing, God help you, and you're just a little shadow in the back of your mind saying something like, well, maybe you're not ready to be completely clean and sober forever yet. Maybe you better wait a little. Or maybe it's too dangerous for you to be sober yet. I just want to assure you, it's just my opinion, but it's right, that you will not go crazy from being sober. It is possible to go crazy while you're clean and sober, but not because you're clean and sober. If you want to go crazy without having a drink, just never tell the truth and never sit still long enough for anyone else to tell the truth at you, and you can go crazy without having a drink. But if we show up one day at a time without a drink or any other chemical at AA meetings and just play ball and listen to other people try to tell the truth, even if they can't do it very well, if they're just giving it a shot, you know, then you just can't stand not getting your turn, and you will jump up and say something true. And when we jump up and say something true, it just heals the heart a little bit, you know? And you don't go crazy, and we just can't stay in enough pain where we have to drink. And it's so deeply healthy and healing, the basic stuff we do around here, that we're just healing. Everything we do is healing, that we're drawn forward by our higher power here. I know I went, after that 6 months, and I went down the tubes faster, picked up momentum, and just a matter of months, I was quitting like crazy after that, and getting worse. I was quitting so much that I wouldn't, if someone offered me a drink, I'd say, just a minute, let me figure out. If I quit for life, this is... And then I decided my main trouble was that I quit too much. I figured, if you quit drinking for life more than 10 times a month, it affects your morale. So I decided that I should probably quit and just smooth out and just be set myself as a drinking man. And I smoothed out at about a fifth of scotch a day and got a number of months of that. Didn't have years of it. I had had kind of a half a year of a fifth a day routine. And I never want to forget what that's like. A fifth a day, by the way, in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous is the only place in the world you can mention drinking a fifth a day and have nobody bat an eye in the whole room. Try it in some other group, you know. And the thing about a fifth a day is that it's not that much, you know, it's less than a quart. Drinking a fifth a day, I had the feeling that I hardly ever got a drink. I was constantly not getting to have a drink. I was constantly, come on, space it out. Don't, we got to make this last, man. You can't get another bottle in the morning. Easy does it. It was tedious, you know. And drinking at that rate, I was tired all the time. I was tired when I was rested up. I was bored by all normal activity. Anything normal was boring. If it was perverted, it was interesting for a few minutes. It was boring. Perverted things were boring after a while. And since everything was boring and I was tired, everything was hard to do. Now, people never appreciate how much pain and suffering we go through while we're drinking to do the simplest things, you know, like get up in the morning, stuff like that. They don't know.
Yeah.
And so, did anyone ever stand beside your bed when you crawled out after 4.5 hours sleep and a fifth of booze the night before and say, far out, this is very admirable. I don't think I could get up if I did that. I think you deserve a little hand, you know. No one ever did it for me either, and I had to congratulate myself for everything I did all day. Every single thing, pretty good, you got up. I know people couldn't, you know. You're eating something. I know people who don't eat. You're eating. They look at you answering the phone. You're not running away. You're facing up to life and responsibilities. Look at you driving your car right down this lane. Look at this, right in the middle of the lane. Smooth stop. Look at this turn. Wouldn't think I was loaded, would you? Takes a lot of the day to congratulate yourself for everything you do. Other thing I'd do instead of living was play a game called Will I Make It? Will I make it to break time without a breakdown? Will I make it through this conversation without them smelling me? Will I make it in the house without them seeing the bottle? And what makes this game exciting is that sometimes we don't make it. It's got a genuine suspense, you know. Olympics every day. Adrenaline rush, man, just pumping in there. That's why it's kind of boring to be sober for the first a little while, you know. Think, well, what do? You know, you eat a meal, you don't even worry about throwing up. Anyway, we get used to it. And the feeling inside is just a dreadful thing. It's dead. I want that to be as vivid to me as I can to, you know, just be the shadow side of the gratitude for being sober and having a life. Is the deadness within when I'm any drinking going on in my life. Two things you got to do to live, and every living thing has to do them, and that's breathe in and breathe out. There's exchange. If it's a living thing, there's nutrients in, and there's action, and there's waste out, and there's action. There's some exchange, or you're not alive. And when I'm drinking, on an emotional and spiritual level, I die. It's not apparent at the time because I'm talking a lot. Other people are talking. But you know, when I'm drinking, it's not the real stuff that comes out. What I have to get out is I've got to get what's in my heart out. I've got to say my thing. And when I'm drinking, everything's top secret material. Well, you can't tell anybody anything, you know. Can't tell what you're really up to. So they say, well, hey, what's up today? Well, I'm just plotting out today's drinking, wondering what. Can't tell people about your finances. I have to get out. I've got to get what's in my heart out. I've got to say my thing. And when I'm drinking, everything's top secret material. Well, you can't tell anybody anything, you know. Can't tell what you're really up to. So they say, well, hey, what's up today? Well, I'm just plotting out today's drinking, wondering what. Can't tell people about your finances, you know. You can't tell people about your finances. You might want to lend a little money, borrow a little money from them, and you don't want them to know they're 31st on the list. You can't tell people how you feel. You know, we just know you shouldn't tell people how you feel. How we feel is so alarming. Someone stops and says, you know, you're looking a little peaked. How you doing? If I was honest, I'd say, well, I feel like an inexorable and irreversible process of disintegration has taken hold. And I'll be dead soon. How you doing? You know? And you can't say that, you know. And you can't tell, even when somebody's interested and kind and smart, you can't be honest with them because they'll try to help you. And it's a lot harder to get a drink when they're trying to help you than any other time, you know. They just crowd you, you know, it's harder. And the other thing, I can't get out what's in my heart, and I can't let anything in. And that, I was sober for a while before that hit me hard. I was, and it's really talking to people who are drink, who are under the influence of drugs or alcohol when I'm not. And you know what that's like. We've all had that experience. And you're talking to somebody, and they're talking away. And you want to get, usually if you're talking to a drunk, a few wonderful things occur to you that'll really help this person, you know, a lot. And they breathe in for a minute, and you jump in and say what you have to say. And after you get done saying it, you wonder if you said it. Because they don't give you anything back to let you know they heard what you said. So maybe you didn't put it right. Maybe we'll reword this, you know. And so you try it again, and they just plow on, you know. And you realize, and you feel dumber and dumber the longer you talk to somebody under the influence, because this person is, and it hit me that that's me. And whatever I was drinking, I am, my life energy is used up by drinking. I have nothing left over to listen with. I cannot listen on an emotional or spiritual level to another human being when I'm under the influence. Nothing left. I'm just barely making it, man. Just making it through the hour. I can't afford to let your thing affect my routine because I just barely hold it together the way it is. You know, I can't. And so I can't let anything in. And I can't let it in, and I can't get it out. I'm dead. And when I'm dead, I hurt bad. And when this person hurts bad, a little thing goes off in the back of my head that says, make sure you get a drink. And I'm describing drinking on a good day. I got in trouble and got escalated trouble with just missing things and causing some scandal in the parish, and was fired. And I went to the hospital. And this was in 1967. There weren't a lot of hospitals around then. And I was kind of young, less than 3 years ordained. But I was wonderful in high. I went to an aversion treatment hospital where they give you a nausea drug and some warm salt water and something. But I was a good sport. I went through that all right. You get five sessions like that in 10 days, and spirit of good sportsmanship, you're supposed to stay sober for the rest of your life. And I went through like a champ. I was the darling of the unit. I was accustomed to highly structured living situations, and I know how to make alcoholic counselors feel fulfilled when I talk to them. And I was sure, this is it, it's all over. It's all settled, I'm an alcoholic, and I'm saying my prayers. And they moved me to a new place, 100 and some miles away. And I was there, and I had one of those revelation obsessions where I just got the message. You ever have one of those? Just, you're going along, you know you'll die if you have another drink. It's all settled. It's not debatable. It's just over. You can't drink. And you just get this revelation.
In 20 minutes, you're going to have a drink.
I say, I'll be damned. I was drinking in 20 minutes. And I've been invited to dinner. This new place, they want to look over the new priest. And it's about 3 days to go before I got to dinner, and I was drinking a little wine during most of that time for the 3 days. And I got there feeling kind of funny, and they offered me a few drinks. Oh, no, just a little wine. And then they called dinner, and I thought, good, we're having dinner. They won't have booze during dinner. And I pictured my liver metabolizing the alcohol. Do you ever have that? You ever see an alcohol molecule? It's big. It's got CHCO. It's a big molecule. And I was picturing this liver breaking down the molecules into acetaldehyde and sugar and water, and I figured, I'll be all right by dessert, you know. And they had some roast beef and some vegetables and mashed potatoes and a little gravy on the mashed potatoes. And next thing I knew, I was down there. Yeah. I came up slow, hoping nobody had noticed. And they said, you all right, Father? I'm just fine. I'm just a little tired. I thought I'd take a nap with the mashed potatoes. and I get all set. And what really made me mad was that I could never remember going down. I get all set and wake up down there again, you know. Then come up slow and wake up down there again, you know. I'm sure the dinner seemed longer for them than for me, you know. I got to go to the hospital again. And I went through, and I was sure I'd never drink after that. You know? And I lasted almost a year. Had another one of those revelation obsessions and was drinking. And I went back after a month of drinking, and it was the third time, and lasted just a few months, and then the fourth time. And the fifth time, they asked me never ever call them up again. I was demoralizing the other patients. And the sixth time, I was detoxed in a regular psychiatric locked unit, and I went from this locked unit to a 12-step house, and it was over for me. You know, I was ice cold cynical by that time, and I went to winter in Jersey. I'm a Southern Californian, and I went to winter in New Jersey with a bunch of broken down old priest alcoholics, and I was the youngest one in the 12-step house by 15 years. I looked at those old guys, and I thought, well, they should stop by this time. You had to go to four AA meetings a week or they wouldn't feed you there. And so I thought, oh, I'll go to meetings. And I was so sure that Alcoholics Anonymous would not help me and would not work. I was so sure that it wouldn't help me that I was relaxed at meetings. I just came in and it's all right, you know, kind of all right with me. And but I wound up going to eight meetings a week instead of four because I liked the guys who were nervous in the house, you know. Go someplace, you know, please. Let's go. And I didn't go to meetings very long until I loved them, you know. And I didn't know why. I just didn't figure that I'd like AA meetings. It's not my type of thing. You know, amateur hour and Protestant church basements. We're in a Catholic one now. But I did. I was, you know, it was working. It was touching. And the program is one thing, but this hand of love reaches right through, and if we're ready, if somehow, and the funny thing about being ready is usually figuring that it won't work. I just knew I'd drink again. Nothing touched me, and I was just sitting there, and I was listening to people. I expected to be lectured, and people didn't lecture. They looked at me and, in effect, said, you know, you're looking kind of tired, and you're looking discouraged. You're looking like you have the feeling you're never going to turn out right. And we'd like to reassure you, you're right. You're not going to turn out the way you think your mother wants you to. You know? But you're going to turn out just fine. You're going to be sober a day at a time and have a life. But you won't turn out your way. You have the look on your face that you're worried you're never going to be happy. And we'd like to hold your hand while you get used to the fact that you're never going to be happy in the way you hoped you'd be happy. But you'll be happy in the way God wants you to be happy. And that's so different than the way you want to be happy that you're happy for weeks at a time before you notice you're happy. Something like that as was said, you know. And I didn't understand it, but I liked it, you know. I just knew somehow people knew what they were talking about here, and I was so embarrassed that I couldn't understand it, but I was glad that something was solid. There was a kindness, you know. There was a blessing. There's a blessing in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. Instead of saying, hey, come on, shape up, be different, there's just a blessing that says, you know, you're a dingbat alky. And we have a higher power who has a record of doing fine with dingbat alcoholics. You know, you don't have to be other than that. You're all right. God can work with you the way you are. Just don't have a drink and play ball, okay? Come on. So I got to do something spectacular. No, just throw the ball back when I throw it to you, okay? That's it. Just don't have a drink and throw the ball back. When someone says hi, say hi. And be willing to be a dingbat alkie of the worst kind. And I remember that was part of my head was, you know, I didn't get that bad. I'm not that bad. And I was just in the program a little while, and it just hit me, I'm that bad. You know, you can't get any worse. Did you drink enough to die from it? You can't get any worse than that. If you could be dead from drinking, that's bad enough. You don't have to get any worse than that. And it's so wonderful to be that bad, because you can relax. And I had this, I don't know, my own story is this driving fear. You know, high ideals and a lot of goodness in my family life and a lot of people, good friends. And I'm an alcoholic who's driven by fear. That'll be good enough. There's a big committee of judges hovering over you, checking everything you do. And there's none there, you know. In my imagination, they're there. You know? And you didn't say, dummy, there's no judges there. You just say, we understand. We understand that you feel judged and rated and embarrassed very easily. And we understand that you would like very dearly to get in good enough shape so that you'll never be embarrassed again. And we're not going to help you do that. No. We're going to help you not have a drink a day at a time, work a program so that you'll get used to being embarrassed. And you won't mind it. And you'll notice that you're loved and that you're treasured and that you're just fine when you're embarrassed and it's all right. It was that kind of stuff. You know, it was like spiritual jujitsu. I kept expecting, you know, to have to try it, and you just lay this easy thing. And I was suspicious all the time. And surrender, I have a graduate unit, upper division units in surrender. I've taken graduate level courses in ascetical theology. That's the principles of spiritual growth and how to be a saint. And I got an A. You know? And I didn't understand it. You know? And you were talking about, and I wanted to surrender right, you know, really get it down. I read all the pamphlets by Dr. Tebow and read extra stuff on surrender and wanted to get this right. You can't do that. You know, I wanted to get it right so that I couldn't be criticized. And so I would be admired a lot. And my higher power has shown a great lack of interest in helping me get in good enough shape so that people admire me a lot. He doesn't seem to be interested at all in that. And as I went along, I was, you know, doing all kinds of thinking about surrender, and my higher power had seen to it without hardly consulting me that I was just taken by the hand and drawn along, and I started surrendering without even knowing that was surrender that I was doing. Surrender to me is willingness to get better somebody else's way. It's to take the hand of Alcoholics Anonymous like a child and walk. You know, that was the thing. AA said to me, will you take my hand? Well, where are you going? Will you take my hand? You like where you've been?
No.
And I say, well, we'll talk about it as we go along, but we want to, please give me your hand. Okay. And then just walk. And I expected, okay, here we go into the spiritual fourth or fifth or sixth dimension. And all they want to do is go to a meeting. And then want me to say my prayers. Well, I said prayers. Well, say them the AA way. Say them with a willingness to not know how to pray. Say them with a willingness to just say thank you for being sober and higher power, have it your way. My own ideas about the way. I've been giving my higher powers instructions for years on how to help me. And he said, I appreciate that you're not giving me any instructions on how to help you. To just be sober, and will you take my hand? And that taking the hand and noticing that I wasn't getting better in the way I dreamed. My dream, I have ego dreams. My dreams are ego dreams. They're getting so that I can't be criticized. In my ego dreams, nothing happens. In the meantime, we're walking along the earth, with the real thing. The real thing is changing from drinking to not drinking. Changing from being sober with a sense of being deprived and heroic to having a sense of deep relief. Oh, thank you, God, that I don't have to beat my brains out figuring out how to get more to drink today. Thank you very much. That's it. And changing from feeling like I'm never having conversations where I'm constantly worried about how I'm doing in the conversation, to actually having somebody say something that touches my heart, and then forgetting on how I'm doing and saying something back and noticing that the other person's touched by the look in their eye, and they say, and I just had a conversation where we had a volley of three things back and forth that was real. And once that happens, you know what that means? That means you're in a normal human life. And that means you never have to have another drink or a pill for the rest of your life, a day at a time. That means life works for you. That means you're in touch with God and your fellows. And that means we're on our way. And thank you very much.
Please fast forward this cassette to the end for safekeeping, and it's